thanks for joining us on this first episode of Against the Mountains of Madness. I'm Jason Rennie, and my other host is John C. Wright. We're going to be talking about philosophy, science fiction, the true, the good, the beautiful, anything and everything that comes to mind. So on that note, this is the first episode. The right place to start is probably, what is philosophy? And the word means the love of wisdom. So where would you go from there? What do you reckon, John?
I would say philosophy is indeed the love of wisdom. Philosophy is motivated by love of wisdom, but it is basically the inquiry into what I will call higher order questions. A low order question is a question with a simple answer based on a surface examination. If you dig deeper as to the roots of things, then you get into the the philosophical questions. So philosophy is not just concerned with the organization and order of nature, which we call natural philosophy or science, but also the fundamental realities that have to be true in all cases, which you call metaphysics. It also deals with what is reality, which we call ontology. It deals with what is knowledge, which we call epistemology. It deals with correct human behavior, which we call ethics or morals. It deals with moral behavior in an ordered city, which we call politics. It deals with what is the beautiful, which we call aesthetics, and so on. So anything that you inquire into deeply enough is a philosophy, if it is a methodical inquiry. Now,
I think that's a very fair answer.
Okay.
Very complete. And I'd also note that everyone has a philosophy or a worldview, a way they see the world, a lens you take everything through. And the catch is you either think about it and have an examined life, as Socrates said, or you just sort of absorb it from your surroundings by osmosis, and it'll still be there, but it's probably not going to be as structured, well thought out, or coherent as the case may be.
Animals can be ruled by instinct, but human beings have to have some sort of ordering, if you will, of their priorities. Some things they think is good and beautiful and true, which they will follow, and other things that they will avoid. And however they end up arranging those priorities, it really is their philosophy. It really is their worldview. The difference, as you correctly point out, is whether or not the worldview is articulate, as it is if you think about it, or is inarticulate, as it is if you merely accept what your first instinct is, what you pick up in your surroundings without investigating it. And as Socrates also said, the unexamined life is really not worth living. If you don't have a philosophy, you don't know why you do what you do. You don't know why you consider some things important and other things not.
That is a good point. So it's important to give some thought to this, even if you don't dedicate your whole life to the pursuit of it. You can.
Well, philosophy is actually a kind of a boring and tedious pursuit, because you have to question things that you think you know, and what you find out is that you don't know what you think you know. And you have to really love wisdom in order to pursue it patiently enough and humbly enough. Philosophers have to be humble, despite that they're wrestling with such great questions, because wisdom will come along and tell you that true wisdom consists of not knowing anything. You find out you don't have any, is what happens if you study wisdom, okay? That's why Socrates was the wisest of men, because he realized he was not wise at all, because he didn't actually know. He thought he knew what truth, justice, beauty, and beauty were, but he didn't really, once he tried to put into words.
Well, actually, suggests an interesting thought to me. The ancient philosophers perhaps were much more humble and patient than modern philosophers, who some of them seem, well, maybe the philosophers aren't wildly arrogant, but those that pretend to it, and, well, actually they all seem to be scientists, now that I think about it.
You're being much too polite. Modern philosophy is garbage. Basically, and I blame Immanuel Kant for it. Immanuel Kant was trying to answer the arch-skeptic David Hume. Now, Aristotle, the last really good philosopher, in my opinion, because he established all the fundamental basics for Thomas Aquinas, and Aristotle was called the master of those who know by scholars in the Middle Ages, and Hume is the master of those who don't know, because he asserted that we can't have knowledge about anything unless we can grasp it with our senses. He was a radical empiricist. Empiricism is the belief that all knowledge is based on sensory impressions. So basically, an empiricist is a guy who believes in science but doesn't believe in asking any questions beyond science. Well, the problem with Hume's posture is that once Hume says, we should take our libraries and throw away every book that maintains an assertion that can't be proved by some observation or experiment, is making an assertion when he says that about what we should do about our books that can't be confirmed by an observation or experiment. So it's a paradox. It's garbage. Now, what Immanuel Kant tried to do was to get out of the paradox that Hume was proposing, was to say there was a difference between real reality, which he called the noumena, and observable reality, which he called phenomena. But by making that distinction, he basically put himself into a posture, unfortunately, where real reality could not be observed, and observable reality was not real. So philosophers after him had to make a distinction between what was true and what was rational, and they said the two were always going to be separate, because you can't see reason, so reason is not true, and you can't reason about facts. Facts are just facts, and so what's true is not rational. And you ended up in a situation where more modern philosophers following that made a choice. People like Wittgenstein said that philosophy was just a logic game with words. It was a thing you did with the reason to show the interrelationship between words, but had nothing to do with reality. And you had people like Nietzsche who said that reality is merely what I take it to be, merely what I assert that it is by my willpower. And Nietzsche doesn't believe that morality is something that can be reasoned about. It's the true philosopher, according to Nietzsche, moves beyond good and evil. Now, I must say that I'm simplifying what these rather deep thinkers have said to an appalling degree. But basically, when philosophy was cut in half by Immanuel Kant, the two halves could not stand by themselves. At the same time, the physical sciences gained so much prestige because of our advances in medicine and technology that the method of the physical sciences, which is empiricism, was so well regarded that any rational inquiry into philosophical questions was dismissed as merely airy wordplay, like Wittgenstein would say it was. So philosophy fell into considerable disrepute, and even things that are regarded, even things that ancients would call philosophy, like the writings of Karl Marx, he is portrayed as an economist, but what he talks about is not actually economics. What he's talking about is a religious or an apocalyptic vision of how world would operate if there was a revolution that somehow overthrew the laws of supply and demand, that if things were just free, then everything would be hunky-dory. Without getting into Marx in any depth, I'll just say that his philosophy is simply a paradox because he also doesn't actually treat it seriously. He doesn't think that the true and the beautiful and the good are coherent. Does that make sense? And from him you get the modern cultural Marxists who believe in things like relativism, the only truth is that there is no truth, or nihilism, or subjectivism, that says everything is in the eye of the beholder, you know.
Yeah. And our culture appears to be dying from it at this point. Yes. Civilization, in fact.
Because that's why you need philosophy. Because if you don't know why you think what you think, then you can't think. And animals can live by instinct, but humans live by thought. And if we don't think, we perish. Our civilization perishes.
Yes. A depressing thought. On that happy note. Okay. So that's what philosophy is without exhausting it. Although I think you and I, we're both Catholics these days. I used to be a Protestant before that, but moved over 18 months ago, 2 years ago now. And one of the things that drew me to the Catholic Church was, the medieval scholastic philosophy of men like Thomas Aquinas, who right. I'm I'm a big fan of Thomas, the great
ox. You're not the only one. I am also.
No, of course.
No, I mean, just as a fair warning to the listeners, I'm also a Thomist, and I believe that Aquinas achieved in philosophy certain fundamental true conclusions that can't be overturned. The same way I believe that Euclid established the basics of Euclidean geometry.
Well, no, I'd agree with you. I've always found Thomas particularly fascinating. Everybody points to his the five ways, which are five arguments for the existence of God based in Aristotle's understanding of causation. If you accept Aristotle's idea about formal causes and final causes and efficient causes and material causes, mm-hmm. He's got a solid argument I don't think has ever really been refuted for the existence of God, at least in the sense of a mind and creator behind the universe. And I think his argument there is solid. The only way you're going to avoid it is to reject Aristotle's understanding of causation, which is about 90% of the problems in modern philosophy, is just trying to discard Aristotle's understanding of causation, and it just opens a can of worms.
You know more about philosophy than I do when you say that. You're quite correct. I spoke with a physicist recently, and this is a guy who's some of his ideas, he got in touch with me because I used some of his ideas in a science fiction story. And he's well-regarded. He's at top of his field, but he didn't believe philosophy existed at all. And I tried to point out to him that saying philosophy does not exist is a philosophical statement because it says that no disciplined inquiry into higher-order questions exists. And he said, well, no. All discipline inquiry into higher order questions is physics. Everything is physics. And I tried to explain to him that if everything were physics, that would mean everything was empirical. And the phrase and the statement, everything is empirical, is itself not an empirical statement. Because to be an empirical statement, you have to be able to observe it. And no one can observe everything. If you're talking about everything, you're talking about categories of beings that embrace all reality, and you're talking metaphysics. Now, you can have a metaphysical belief that there's no such thing as metaphysics. In fact, most modern philosophers adopt that belief, but it's a paradox. It's merely nonsense. So I could not explain to my physics friend why he was saying was sheer nonsense, even though he's a highly educated man, smarter than I am. But he couldn't see that if you say 2 plus 2, you can't say 2 plus 2 is equal to not 2 plus 2. You can't say A is not A, no matter how smart you are. His problem was he could not see that there was more than one type of causation. In science, they only are concerned with efficient cause, the historical cause of what makes the cue ball hit the 8-ball and move the 8-ball into the side pocket, okay? The actual mechanics of how the balls hit each other. But if you say, well, why is that a scratch? What's the rule of pool that makes it so you're not supposed to hit the 8-ball in that way? You can't learn that answer by studying the motion of the billiard balls. You can't learn that answer by studying the efficient cause. You have to find out the final cause, which is the aim of the action.
Yep.
See? Now, physicists often think that science says there's no final cause in nature, but that's not true. What science says, when it's properly understood, I should make a distinction here between science and science worshipers. What science says is that they cannot investigate final cause in nature, so they will leave that question to the philosophers. What science worshippers say is that science has investigated all of nature and made various metaphysical and philosophical conclusions that just so happen to be the same conclusions that cultural Marxists, relativists, and nihilists all happen to agree with, you see?
Yeah.
It's because science in the modern day has prestige and philosophy in the modern day is scorned.
Yeah, well, yes. It's interesting that they've mistaken doesn't exist for out of scope, effectively.
If you have a hammer, to a hammer, every problem is like an ant. If you have a method that's highly successful for answering certain types of questions, it's really easy to step into the the mistake of saying this answers all questions. But then when you start doing things that are, let me just take an example. The Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics makes an assertion about the nature of observation and the nature of human consciousness that is not a physics question. That is to say, it's not a question that you could find out if it were true or false by confirming it through an observation or an experiment. There's no way to set up a thought experiment to say, what happens when I observe as opposed to don't observe an unobserved particle? any statement you make about an unobserved particle is not a statement of physics. It's a statement of metaphysics. It's a statement of whether or not the particle has properties like cause and effect and consistency of existence, persistence of reality. Okay. That's not a physics question. That's a philosophy question. And if you take the Copenhagen interpretation and you to the its logical extreme and go off the edge of a cliff with it and say, well, there's no such thing as cause and effect. There's only statistics. A, you can't have statistics without cause and effect. And B, that's not a physics question. You can't prove that because now you're making an assertion about an unknown, that you can't observe, an unobservable. Well, you can make metaphysical conclusions about things that are unobservable, like whether or not reality is real, but you can't make an empirical conclusion about the unobservable because empiricism is based on what you observe.
What's observable? I'd be interested to know what your physics friend makes of biology as a discipline, which, I mean, is a science, but try doing biology without final causes.
I didn't ask him that question, but I did ask him about Aquinas. And he said that he could disprove Aquinas' four or five causes arguments by means of disproving Aquinas' physics. And I said, those arguments don't address physics. They don't rely on any idea of physics. Those arguments are either true in every possible universe or not true in every possible universe. But they're not true in some universes and not others. They're not true in a Newtonian universe and not in an Einsteinian universe. Okay, they're not true in a Ptolemaic universe, but true in a Galilean universe, if you understand what I'm saying. Because metaphysics is true throughout. It's true regardless of observation. Physics is true dependent on observation. He then said he was defining his terms in some non-standard way, and at that point he called me a fool and started calling me names. And so I thought, well, maybe modern science for science worshippers consists of taking things on authority, but that's not what science in the old days did.
No, well, I've encountered that sort of I can scientifically disprove Aquinas's five ways, and then anybody saying that invariably, in my experience, I'm sure you could find an exception. They'll talk about.
I have not found an exception yet. So continue your statement.
But Aquinas talks, like, one of his arguments is from motion in the universe, like observing motion in the universe, going back to a first mover. And then they'll immediately start talking about, I forget what it is. Either way, they think motion is movement through space. And they think that's what Aquinas is talking about. And he's not. Motion is just change. Any change of any sort is motion in, you know, the language of Aquinas' times. And it's sort of sitting there listening to someone talking and going, oh, you're trying to disprove something you don't understand at all. Like,
that's why philosophers have to be patient and humble, because defining your terms correctly and making sure you're both on the same page, where you're talking about motion in the sense of change, and he's talking about kinetic motion in the sense of the cue ball hitting the billiard ball, you're talking across purposes, and you're not going to get it.
Yeah, of course.
The difference is that you and I, as people who've studied philosophy and therefore know that we don't know anything, are willing to sit there and ask someone what they mean, whereas the science worshiper assumes a posture of knowledge which is unjustified. He assumes he knows what he doesn't know. You know, and it's a blasphemy. It's a blasphemy against philosophy.
Of course. But I'd certainly be interested to know what your physicist friend thinks of biology. For example, tell me what a heart is and what it does without invoking a final cause like pumps blood. Like it has a purpose. It does a thing.
Tell me what an eyeball is without saying it is for a purpose.
Yeah,
for seeing. What a wing is without saying it's for something. You know?
Exactly. And you want to be able to.
Once you say it aims at a purpose. Yeah. Even things like determining the path a photon will follow when moving from the medium of air to the medium of water, certain physicists evoke final cause. They say the photon is aiming at, is trying to follow the path of least distance when it does that. Okay? So, the idea that the Aristotelian causes do not apply is one of the most foolish ideas that afflicts the modern age. And I laid the blame at the feet of people like Hume and Kant. But I also have to lay the blame on the wars of religion, the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation that shipwrecked Christendom back in the day. Now, this is how you know I'm a Catholic. No one except a Catholic would refer to that as a disaster because, of course, to the Protestants, it seemed to be a revolution that overthrew a tyranny.
Yeah.
But for better or worse, whether you're Catholic or Protestant, you have to agree that the parts of Europe began to not be able to have conversations on metaphysical topics because they were too close to theological topics where the disagreement was illegal. If you held an opinion that was contrary to your national church, then you would be in danger of blasphemy, which was at that time the foundation of their civilization, and you could end up being killed. So if they stuck to questions of weights and measures and relative motions of billiard balls and the motions of the stars, then they were not going to get into any. They were not going to get into any religious controversy. You see?
No, I agree with you. Although I'd say part of the problem.
So everyone started to just avoid theological questions. Metaphysics started to be what was dethroned from the queen of the sciences, and the other Aristotelian causes of formal. Final and material were discarded and no longer given any place of honor among scholars. The only thing scholars were interested in was science, was physics, natural philosophy.
Well, I'd also argue the cancer goes back before the Reformation to men like William of Ockham, of Ockham's razor fame. Do not multiply entities beyond necessity. But when he introduced nominalism, as yes. opposed to and denied the existence of, well, I don't think it would be fair to say he necessarily would have denied universals the way the modern nominalist does. But he tried to find an in-between position and set much of philosophy down that. Path to nominalism where there are no universals. Everything is just a specific instance of different things.
For those of our listeners who are not familiar with the terminology, nominalism is basically the philosophy that says that any universal concept like a horse or a chair is built up over a large number of particular instances of what all chairs have in common, what all horses have in common. And H.G. Wells, the famous science fiction writer, once said that there's no such thing as chair as a universal. And G.K. Chesterton, the famous detective writer, said, well, if there's no such thing as chairs, you can't say there's no such thing as chairs, because you have to refer to chair as a concept to deny it. Nominalism is the first step to the kind of relativism, nihilism, and basically anti-intellectualism that is the sine qua non, that is the defining characteristic, the leitmotif of modern. And I do agree with you. I think nominalism is where the seed began to sprout. And because the churchmen of the Middle Ages, of course, thought that since everything came from God, all forms came from God. The truth, the true and the beautiful and the virtuous all came from God. And whether you believe in God or not, you have to say that there's such a thing as true, good, and beautiful. And if there is a God, those things are coherent with each other. They have to be. If there's not, you're left without an explanation as to why they cohere with each other. You're left without an explanation as to why the human mind happens to be rational in the same way the universe happens to be rational. And you're left with a lot of questions that can't really be answered. Now, this is not to say that Christianity answers all questions. There's questions about the problems of pain that are quite deep and quite profound, and Christians don't have it's not an answer that I think you can answer in a flip way or quickly. It's a serious question.
Oh, it's a serious question. I agree.
I believe there is an answer. I believe Christ is the answer, but it's a serious question. But if you're an atheist, if you say there is no God, not only you're saying there's no Christian God, but you're saying there's no Aristotelian prime mover, because that's actually God. You're saying there's no Platonic archetype of the highest good, because that's also God. You see, you're saying that there's no answer to a variety of very deep philosophical questions, I would say at least 8 or 10 of them, that are just as fundamental as the problem of pain. Basically, you have the question of where virtue comes from, where reason comes from, what the meaning of life is, and why humans... Where does music come from? I mean, you can't say the human creative impulse to write music, it comes from nature, because nature has certain repetitive pleasant sounds, but there's more to music than that. Mm. There's just a wide variety of things that you can't answer once you don't have this answer. And the nominalism in the Middle Ages was trying to make a human answer to the question of universals, what philosophers call the questions of the one and the many. Are all chairs participating in one concept of a chair? Does the ideal come first and then the various members participate in it? Or do the members come first and the set is merely by convenience arbitrarily decided? Now, you might think this question is highly abstract and is of no import, but I know a woman who lost her faith in God because of that question, the question of knowledge. She doesn't believe that she herself exists. She told me, I don't exist. Because the I-ness, what that word referred to, she thought was a group of particular properties that happened to intersect arbitrarily in what she thought of as a person, namely herself. Now,
that's tragic.
I can't think of anything more insane than that. Okay, that's like saying this sentence has no meaning. It's like saying the only truth is that there is no truth. It's a direct self-contradiction. You can't be more illogical than that, than to say, what I've determined is that I don't exist. Well, if you don't exist, then who made the determination? You know,
that's not an uncommon position in a lot of philosophy of mind, because it's
correct.
Keeps trying to break people down into, you know, like you.
Into
you
keep trying to break things down. Trying to break things down into observable phenomenon. But observable phenomena are all things that are particulars that come from universals. And if you don't see the universal because it's an ideal, an abstraction, then you can't see it at all. And so all you can say is the particulars exist. And you can't explain why the human mind categorizes those particulars as one thing. How do I know that I'm me and not just a pile of sand blown together by the wind for a moment into a human shape? Okay, that question is nonsensical, because if you're just a pile of sand, who's asking the question?
Question.
You see? So here's John Wright's first rule of philosophy, which is you can't adopt any philosophy that eliminates the philosopher from existence. Okay? Any philosophy that tells you that either A, you don't exist, or B, you can't ask that question, invalid. Okay? Self-defeating. What's sad is that nearly all modern philosophy falls into that category, falls into that rubric. It's as if philosophy has gone insane. Now, again, to return to the question of why we need philosophy, when your philosophy goes insane, your society goes insane. Whether you know it or not, philosophy is the soil in which the hidden roots are buried. You can't see them because they're roots, but the fruit, the trunk, the branches, and the fruit of what you have planted comes to bear. So if you start saying the only truth is there's no truth, everyone has his own truth, the fruit you have to bear is a drag queen story hour for children.
Yep. Oh, no, I agree with you. Our entire society has gone insane and has lost its way in a big way. Although one final comment on Thomas Aquinas before we move on to the move on a little bit. One of the everybody talks about Thomas's five ways and why they are, wants to argue about them. I've always found Thomas has another argument further along in his Summa Theologicae, which is what is man's final end? Like, basically...
End in the person, meaning of aim. Yeah, what purpose?
Yeah, what should you? What should you? What will make you happy effectively? Happy?
Not quite. What are you designed to do? The way a hammer is designed to pound nails.
Sort of.
Darwin says we're designed to survive and procreate and nothing else. And that answer is clearly unsatisfactory because if you just are alive and you've managed to procreate, okay, your selfish gene is happy, but what do you care? See? So Aquinas has an actual answer to the question, whereas modern philosophy does not have an answer to the question.
No, that's true. No, but it was interesting that his argument goes through. It was I should look it up. But he starts with things in the world to try to make you will make you happy and satisfy your deepest longings. And he starts with money and says,
I have to insist. You can't stay happy. It serves your good, but something.
Okay, that's true. No, I agree.
He's not a hedonist. He's not a eudaimonian. He's not a guy who says that the purpose of life is to seek happiness. The purpose of life is to seek the good. Slightly different, but significant.
Okay. Well, okay. But if you find the good, you will be happy. So I don't know. Well, you will be... you're right. Eudaimonia is the right word, and that's blessed. That means something closer to blessed than...
It means having good spirit.
Happy, but... Yes, but I'm going to say happy because everyone, because it'll do.
No, it won't. No, well,
no, you're right. I agree.
It would deceive people because they think that wine, women, and song will make them happy. We're mortal. We're going to die. So we should eat, drink, and be merry. But that's not. You're talking about true happiness, not just pleasure.
No, that's not.
You're talking about joy. You're talking about bliss. You're talking about the kind of thing where a martyr can go singing to her death, you see, which is even more stoical than a stoic like Cato of Utica, who was able to stab out his guts rather than surrender to Caesar. And he fainted while doing it and had to pull them out with his hand. He was a very stern man, Cato, and all the Roman stoics were. But they were not living for happiness, but for the good, for doing what was virtuous. Now, a Christian has an advantage over a stoic because we can do what is virtuous with joy in our hearts, with hope when there's no hope. But it's more than happiness. It's something that makes happiness.
No, that's true.
It's something that makes happiness possible. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I will concede your point. But okay. It was fascinating to watch him go through his eight steps. And the first thing he said, money will make you happy. And it's just like, no, that's dumb. And he puts an argument forward. And it's just like, you know, that's the first one. So the assumption is that's the stupidest possible one you can choose. Money's a means to an end. It can't make you happy. It can't be an end in itself because its very purpose is to buy things. So, you know, money won't make you happy. And then he goes through
Which is not to say that poverty will not make you unhappy. But there are people who can live. But there are people who can live without possessions who are not unhappy, and we call them monks. They're a living rebuke to the idea that money is the source of happiness.
No, that's true. But he goes through. There's eight steps, and I can't remember them all off the top of my head. But he starts with money.
If you look in the Book of Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon the Wise, I think you'll see the same eight steps of what things will make you happy as opposed to not make you happy in this life. And well, he says it's all vanity. He says the vanity of vanities, it's all vanity.
Well, what I thought was interesting about the argument was it was a very solid logical argument. And he goes, money won't work, honors won't work, good repute doesn't work, pleasure doesn't work, good health doesn't work, wisdom doesn't work. Whatever it is, it has to be beyond this world. And basically, it has to be God. There's nothing else that will...
Right.
You know, there's nothing else that will do the job. And I've put the question to atheists over the years. We can argue about Thomas's five ways, blah, blah, that's fine. Let's deal with this one. Like, if Thomas is right, and I want you to show me where Thomas is wrong, you're stuck in a world where you can never truly See, this is where I want to say, be happy, but as we've established, it's broader than that.
No, but you're right. But in that sense, you're correct. Because all I said was, the good is without the good, you can't be happy. And I didn't say, but I didn't say that the good consisted of happiness. That was my only distinction there.
Ah, yes.
You can say that without God, you can't be happy. But as an ex-atheist, I can tell you, when I was an atheist, I was a stoic. I tried to copy Cato of Utica rather than copying Christ. You can tell what a person's philosophy is by who they try to copy. Well, a stoic tries to put aside fear of death. No, he tries to put aside fear of death with his willpower, you see, and he tries to put aside his longing for honors and for money because these things are not in his control, okay? Because the pagans knew, the atheists know, or they should know, that happiness does not come from those things. You can't find the good in life by seeking the pleasures in life, okay? Yeah. So, but without God, that's your choice. Your choice is stoicism and hedonism. Your choice is pursuing pleasure and pursuing virtue. But your virtues are not going to be satisfactory because you're mortal. Everything you do is going to die. Everyone you love is going to die. Every nation you serve is going to die. Every ideal you serve is going to die. It's all vain. Okay, that is the basic problem. You want to talk about the problem of pain? Atheists have to deal with the problem of piffle. Everything they do is piffle. Here's the fundamental problem. This is what I think Thomas was getting at. The fundamental problem is if there's no God, there's no law higher than human law. There's no aim higher than a human aim. There's no meaning higher than a meaning you arbitrarily assigned for yourself by yourself. You see? If there's a higher good, then you can say your aim is wrong because you're not aiming at the right thing. You can say your law is unjust because it doesn't serve the higher law. You can say your morals are wrong because they don't adhere to objective morality. But if there's no God, that means no objective morality. That means no objective meaning to life. That means no objective truth. It means everything is human opinion or human interim conclusions. Well, if the meaning of life is whatever meaning you assign to it, that's arbitrary. And the word arbitrary means meaningless.
Yes.
So how can you find the good in meaninglessness? Just make it up out of your head? Well, if you think the ideals don't exist, if you just believe in the particulars like a nominalist does, then how are you even going to find that, you see? You're going to end up like, I mean, I have to give credit to my friend of mine who said she didn't exist because at least she logically came to the conclusion that was implied by her premises. Once you say there's no such thing as being, once you say there's nothing outside the human mind, I should say no thoughts outside the human mind, no objective truth. You dissolve everything into a cloud of nothing. So Aquinas is quite correct. Why am I even bothering to say that? Of course. it's like saying Euclid is right about geometry. Yes. Thomas is correct that without God, you can't organize even a thought of what life is for or why it exists or why it's rational. You know?
Oh, yes, but I always thought it was a fascinating argument because...
Oh, it is.
I presented it to people, and it's like, okay, you could prove God doesn't exist, but then you're stuck with nothing you do is of value, and you can't find a proper point to your existence.
Now, there are philosophers who try their best to say that, and you've got to give them credit, to say that merely by being alive, you are making an assertion of value. You prefer life to death. You say life is more valuable than death. And so, and since reason is what humans have to use to stay alive, you also have to say reason is more valuable than unreason. And you can derive a large amount of what traditional morality would also say is moral just from that very small premise, just from that little tiny stepping stone. You can get to a wide variety of things that you'll have to find out that if logic is logical, you have to also agree that good is good and that moral behavior is moral, you know, and so on and so forth. So you can get to a philosophy that you could cooperate with a Christian rather nicely, but it's all based on a rather arbitrary idea that life is worth living, which modern philosophers say it's not. That's what nihilism. I mean, not every nihilist is suicidal, but nihilism says that meaning is not objective, doesn't adhere in life, you say. So, and there are guys like Stephen Molyneux, who was unfairly driven off of social media And writers like Ayn Rand, who I have great respect for, even though she's wrong about nearly everything, she's right where she agrees with Aristotle, who tried to come up with at least some answers to the meaning of life, but they can't overcome the flaw that what they're talking about is at its root an arbitrary assertion. You see, they can't say that I believe this because reality says so. They follow Nietzsche, whether they know it or not, and say, I believe this because I say so. Well, that's not a good reason to believe anything.
No.
Because I say a lot of nonsense.
So, with all of that prelude, you're a science fiction writer.
Yes, I am.
I'm a science fiction fan, and I've published science fiction and things like that over the years. I published some of your books and stories at one time. Where do you think the arts and philosophy... Well, I used to do the sci-fi show, Science Fiction and Philosophy podcast, published a magazine along those lines for a little while. Didn't make any money doing it, so I had to give it up. But bought one of your stories. Bought a couple of your stories, I think. But science fiction... Where does science fiction come into philosophy, do you think? Or what do you think the interface is between science fiction and philosophy?
Excellent question. let's first define what science fiction is. And that's an easy question. All science fiction fans will agree immediately where the boundaries of the genre lie. No, I'm kidding. Science fiction is one of those things where, like a heffalump, you know what it is when you see it, but otherwise it's kind of hard to say. But I would say science fiction is the mythology of a scientific age. A mythology is not a false story. A mythology is a story that is not literal, but speaks to a deeper truth. Yep. And in a scientific age, the basic certain fundamentals of the worldview are agreed upon by everyone who participates in that consensus. And so in a scientific age, you believe that science will change the world, maybe for the better, as in Star Trek, or maybe for the worse, as in 1984. Okay, but things are not going to stay the same. So science fiction, whether even the simplest of adventure stories or the most shallow of nostalgic stories will have to address with how do you deal with the changes brought by technology? What is man's place in the universe that science teaches us? Most of the early science fiction of people like H.G. Wells gave a rather negative, I'll call it Victorian answer, where they looked at the size and scope of the universe and said, man is a speck in this universe. Man is merely an animal produced by a mindless Darwinian process with no particular center to it. And H.P. Lovecraft, an author whose greatness is often overlooked, and I think criminally so, had an answer that was so desolate and so nihilist that everyone regards him as a horror writer, even though what he really was, in my opinion, was a science fiction writer who happened to come to one of the conclusions of a scientific worldview, if you have science without God, which is to say that the world is so vast and so complicated and so incomprehensible that if you find out the truth, it will drive you mad. I don't know. Nearly every H.P. Lovecraft character finds out some horrible truth that drives him insane. Now, the difference between him and H.G. Wells is only a matter of approach. The time traveler in H.G. Wells travels to the far future and finds out that the class distinctions in England, if left unchanged, will produce a race of cannibal murderers and a race of helpless food animals, the Morlocks and the Eloi. Now, this is very interesting science fiction speculation, and I didn't expect to see them in the modern age, you know, running our society. But basically, Wells was portraying the outcome of the worldview of the scientific age. And he was telling a myth. He wasn't saying it was literally going to happen, but he was portraying it as fiction. So, science fiction is the mythology about man's place in the universe given technological change. Well, to answer man's place in the universe, you have to address it scientifically. I think this makes science fiction uniquely qualified, more qualified than mainstream fiction, to answer and address certain philosophical questions. Such as, if you want to know what is man, it would be useful to step outside man and look at it from another point of view. So if you have a character, we don't know any real aliens, and few people speak to angels, but if you had a character who was not a human being, a robot, a Vulcan from planet Vulcan, or so on, they can make observations about human nature that humans are not in a position to make without being accused of bias. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Without being, with, like, a good judge recuses himself from a case. So if you have a science fiction story where you introduce a clone or a robot or a space alien, they can make observations about humanity, or if you're writing fantasies, an undead, a vampire, a werewolf, an mm-hmm. elf, can make observations about mankind that mankind cannot make objectively himself. It gives you a different point of view. You can also ask questions about cause and effect if you're in a time travel story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes very interesting questions, you know. You can also ask questions that about life and death if you write a ghost story. Now, ghost stories are not science fiction because you don't need the technology to believe in ghosts. In fact, it's not until you have technology that people stop believing in ghosts, even though ghosts obviously exist. I mean, who can deny they exist? It's ridiculous to say otherwise. I mean, soon people stop thinking there's UFOs. So what can you do with such absurd skeptics? No, I'm kidding. I don't actually think that UFOs are – I think that UFOs are crewed by ghosts mostly and probably demonic. In any case, I mean, because rationally, you know, logically, if they had come here from another planet, you know, they would land on the White House lawn, and you'd have the events from Day of the Earth Stood Still. Because I get all my ideas as to what's realistic from science fiction stories.
Okay. Fair enough.
Slightly confusing answer, but the short answer is science fiction, by its nature, tends to delve into deeper questions because you kind of have to if you're going to answer a question about a speculation about the nature of man in the universe. And philosophical questions so naturally lend themselves to science fiction, even adventure stories. Something like Star Trek asks questions about why mankind on Earth these days doesn't cooperate, but the bridge of the Starship Enterprise has all races, you know, Russians and Americans and Vulcans all cooperating together. It's asking you a question about the nature of not just of mankind, but also just all rational life, Vulcan kind as well. In Star Wars, you have questions about the nature of what makes the mystical force is a kind of an almost Buddhist or Taoist idea of a mystical layer beyond what is visible. And even though it's just a nice nostalgic adventure story, I call it nostalgic because it's hearkening back to 1940s style Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. It's meant to be an homage to those days. And that's why it takes place long ago and far away, because it's a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale with a science fiction background, which makes it science fiction. Now, that won't be controversial as to saying where the boundary of science fiction is. But even that has to deal with deeper questions, including questions of redemption and forgiveness. Luke Skywalker finds out who his dad is. I won't spoil it. His dad is Rosebud the Sled. Whether to forgive him or not, and that's based partly on his understanding of the universe as something beyond what can be seen with the eye, you see?
Hmm.
So, science fiction lends itself quite naturally to the same material. I called it a myth for the modern age. I should call it a fairy tale for the modern age, because fairy tales, all no matter how simple they are, they're always deep. They always speak to the core of the moral reality of the universe that people are talking about. Cinderella has the same moral core as the Canticle of Mary, that the meek shall be uplifted and the proud shall be cast down, for example. You see? Snow White has the same moral as the Passion of Christ, where even death can be awoken by love's first kiss if love is divine. You see?
Okay. So this does raise a question, because there is a lot of great science fiction that asks all sorts of interesting questions. I've published some, you've written some, lots of people have written lots of interesting science fiction that asks lots of interesting questions. Why is so much of it crap today? Why is it so frequently awful?
There's two answers to that. One is Sturgeon's Law, 90% of anything is crud.
That's true.
But nowadays, we're getting to a point where almost all of it is crud, and that's a separate question. What's different now than it used to be? Why is modern Star Trek postmodern garbage, whereas old Star Trek is still watchable? That's a better question. Why is Disney Star Trek? Why is Disney Star Wars anti-Star Wars? Actually, directly against the point, purpose, and moral of what Star Wars stood for. Because I just said Luke Skywalker stood for forgiveness. He's the guy who didn't give up hope on his father, even though his father was a genocidal maniac. It was as evil as you can be. Okay. Modern Disney, the Last Jedi version of Luke Skywalker, who I will call Mopey Sulkwalker because I do not believe he deserves the same name as that well-beloved hero of the screen, he's willing to give up on his nephew sight unseen, before the nephew does anything. He's willing to kill the yet lad in his sleep. Okay, the difference is the philosophy. The philosophy of the modern age, which is known as the Woking Dead, are people who... that's not my joke. That comes from a guy named Rice. The Woking Dead have rejected all of Christ. Now, Christ is the truth, the life, and the way to salvation. They don't believe in salvation. They think that if you're white, you're born damned, and if you're a minority, you're blessed no matter what. They don't believe in hope. They think that the only violent revolution to overturn society will create a utopia. But nowadays, unlike doctrinaire Marxists, they never talk about utopia anymore. They don't think it's going to happen. They just want to see it destroyed. So they spend their time tearing down monuments. They tear down the statues of Civil War generals first, but then they want to tear down all statues because they want to have control over the past, because whoever, as George Orwell warned us in the book 1984, a science fiction book, whoever has control of the past has control of the future. Well, what monuments do modern Americans and people in the West generally admire nowadays? The things in pop culture. I mean, maybe we're a little shallow, but the pop cultural icons are our icons for a reason. Star Wars represents hope. Star Trek represents the unity of a vision of mankind. So Star Trek has to become woke in order to become racist, in order to say that, no, all races will not cooperate. The Klingons are MAGA Trumpsters and are villains who have to be destroyed. And woke Star Wars says no. You don't have to train to become a Jedi. If you're a woman, you're already Mary Sue. You're already born perfect. And if you're a man, there's nothing you can do. You're worthless. You see. And the reason why they have to destroy Star Trek and Star Wars, and also Terminator, and also Charlie's Angels, and also Ghostbusters, and also James Bond. And also, I mean, name a franchise. They buy these intellectual properties to destroy them. And, unfortunately, the Eloi are ruled by the Morlocks. The Eloi are their helpless victims that just are consumed by these creatures. And there are Eloi who have been taught since childhood in public schools, I should say government-run schools, that true virtue consists of never having any virtue. True virtue consists of tolerating vice. The toleration is all you need to be perfect, and that perfection consists of allowing the imperfections of others to dominate your society.
Tolerance.
Well, tolerance is the virtue of having no virtue at all.
It's the virtue of encouraging
vice. Okay.
In order to encourage vice,
you have to destroy stories, because stories always have a moral core. Even a tragedy has a moral core. You can see that Hamlet should have been more decisive. You can see that Othello should have been less decisive. You know, you can see what the point of these stories is. Maybe some of them are more subtle than others. And there are stories like, you know, torture porn stories that don't have a moral core to them. They're nihilist, basically. I noticed that the Walking Dead don't desecrate those stories. They desecrate the ones that are good. And the ones that are good, what makes a good story is beauty. You can portray a tragedy with depth and sublimity. I don't mean every story has to be, when I say beauty, I don't mean every story has to be rainbows and kittens. Okay, you can tell the story of the Passion of the Christ is one of the bloodiest things you could imagine, but it also culminates every other lesser story that led up to it and came from it. Okay, woke is a Christian heresy. It doesn't make any sense outside of the Christian worldview that says you should have compassion for the meek, the poor, and the weak. Because if you said to a pagan, I'm a victim, I need a safe space, you're triggering me, the pagan would say, crouch, slave, I'm Achilles the Great. I read the poem called the Pharisalia, which has a character that's interesting named Amiklos the Fisherman, who is so poor that he sleeps under a boat. He doesn't have a house. He's the only one who's not afraid of Caesar because he owns nothing, and so Caesar can't take anything away from him. And he's the one Caesar appoints to sail him across the ocean so he can go do some glorious deed because he's Caesar. And it was an amazing scene to read it from modern eyes because he never thanks Amiklos nor recognizes Amiklos's bravery and virtue for taking him through a storm that no one else is willing to go through. When they manage to get through the storm, Caesar doesn't say thank you for your skill at navigating through the dangerous waters. He says, even the gods can't stop me with their stupid storm because I am Caesar and destiny has assigned that I shall be great. Okay, that kind of man is not going to pay any attention to someone whose only claim to fame is that they are a weak victim. Okay?
Yeah.
So, but a Christian has been taught to have compassion for the weak, for the poor. But they're blessed, in fact. Well, what the woke do is they take that idea and they say, the reason why men are poor and weak is not because of sin, but because of oppression. And the oppressor is you. And the oppression is that you, Americans, freed the slaves, that you, British, stopped the international slave trade. And the poor black people who enslaved the blacks and sold them to the whites, they're your victims. Okay? Now, their claim makes no sense at all because it's just stupid. But they also say that it is oppression to use reason. They also say that thinking, being punctual, all that's being white, all that's being too white.
Okay. Yes.
Even though I'm sure there are people who are not from Europe who have been on time, I'm confident that in the court of the Chinese emperor, his servants were not tardy when he demanded something of them.
No.
Be that as it may. You can't tell a good story if you don't have the true, the good, and the beautiful. The beautiful can also consist of things that are horrible to contemplate. Okay. But they have to be grounded in reality, in higher reality. Because what a story is like I said, using a falsehood to tell a truth. There's certain truths you can't put into words. And if you just wrote it out like a newspaper report, you'd miss the point. But if you say, once there was a girl who was a servant in her own house and she slipped by the fire and they called her Cinderella, you'll get the idea. Or if you say, once there was a prodigal son who took his father's inheritance and went to a far country and wasted and riotous living. You'll suddenly get the idea, and a complicated idea too, that you otherwise can't say. That's what stories are for. But stories have to serve the truth, even though they're not literally true. Okay?
Hmm.
I put it this way. When God gave man the gift of speech, he gave Adam the ability to name things, which no animal can do. But the devil tempted Adam and said, why don't you use that power for evil and use your power of speech to tell lies? And then God gave man a gift and said, hey, why don't you use your power to tell lies, to tell the truth, and be creative like me and be a creator? And that's what they call poetry. Okay? So the reason why the modern stories are just abominable is because they are intentionally abominable. They're deliberately abominable. They reflect the worldview of people whose worldview is nihilistic. They don't believe in true or false. Is subjectivist. They think that they're God and that God's not God. They think that they can create reality by an effort of will, that is deeply racist, deeply bigoted, filled with hatred for their benefactors, I should just say by and large, and their economic worldview is Marxist, which is just basically envy. Marxism is simply envy writ large. It's with some excuses, larded with excuses. Mm-hmm. So their worldview is based on envy, hatred, nothingness, and despair. And they claim to be smarter than us because they don't think about things. They claim to be more virtuous than us because they adhere to vices. And they claim to be better because they're victims, because they're worse than us, because they're weaker than us. So from that worldview, what kind of story do you think you could tell? You could tell one story. It's the story of Mary Sue, the perfect girl, whose only flaw is that society does not sufficiently recognize her genius. And her plot conflict consists of men who try to oppress her, but they're pathetic and they fail. And at the end, she is perfect. The end. That's the only story they know how to tell, and it's a boring story.
Because it's a boring story.
True. And no truth means no beauty.
Fair enough. And I think that is a good place to end this first episode. So thank you for joining me today, John, and we'll be back next week with more Against the Mountains of Madness. Like and subscribe.
And we should say, we should not only say like and subscribe, we should explain why we call it this Mountains of Madness, because the thing that I was just denouncing is madness, and it is gigantic these days, and we are going to oppose it, you and me.
Yes. All right. Thanks again, John, and we'll talk again in a week.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.